Good. Well, it's really good to be with you. Nice to see you all. Just nosing around to see who there is and all the familiar faces. But it's great to see you. Thanks for coming. If you've not been here before, you're in for an absolute treat. We've got a humdinger of a story shortly, and I'll be interviewing Billy. And then after that, we're going to look at a little passage of the Bible and sort of draw things to a close. There's a little bit of a disconnect between what I'm going to say from the Bible and the story. It's because I'm very conscious that there's a general election, and I thought we'd be a little bit topical. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you which party to vote for, but I thought let's be topical and see. Anyway, you'll see. Before that, let me mention the bookstall. Now, this is a church that's always got a bookstall, I know that, but I brought a few things. They just fall into the boot of my car, and they're resources which are incredibly cheap, really cheap. So most of them are just £1 each, but the others, if they're more expensive, are greatly reduced in price. I don't make any profit from any of the books. But I want you to know it's not a Tupperware party. You don't have to buy anything. It's just there as a resource, all right? So let me mention those. Then I'm going to read the Bible, then I'll introduce to you Billy. I really should have promoted this yesterday, but maybe it would have been a little bit insensitive. Last night we had a chap called Jeremy Marshall, who was the CEO of Hawes Bank, which is a bank for multimillionaires. I know that because he told us. I don't think he'd be at all interested in me, but Three or five years ago, he was diagnosed with cancer, and he was told he had between 6 and 18 months to live. But we had him here last night telling his story, and there's no doubt he challenging to listen to a man facing death and yet so confident in Christ. There is this little book called On My Way to Heaven. It was written by an Anglican clergyman in Cambridge, Mark Ashton, who was diagnosed with leukemia. And actually, he was to die 9 months later. But in those 9 months, he just penned this little book. And you'd think, oh, that's a gloomy thing to be mentioned. It's not at all. It's the most, uplifting book. His final words on earth were, "Soon home." Well, I've spoiled the ending of the book now. But anyway, it's just £1, and it's a lovely little book if you want to follow that theme. Now, I know there's great excitement across the nation about what will happen tomorrow, isn't there? And, of course, that's because we've got a Yorkshire tea in the tent at 2 o'clock. Everybody's welcome. They've said senior citizens, but to be honest, you're all welcome. You all look pretty senior. In fact, most of you look very senior, so everybody's welcome. We're going to give you a Yorkshire tea. We've got Yorkshire food. We're going to talk all things Yorkshire. We have a psychiatrist on hand for those from Lancashire. So we've covered every eventuality. But listen to this. 2 weeks ago, this book came out. Oh, I think it's wonderful. It's called Fine Gold from Yorkshire. And it's supposed to be £9.99. I've got them at £3.50. And it's 31 biographies of famous Yorkshire Christians in history. And there are loads of them. It's really interesting. Anne Bronte. John Wycliffe, the first man to translate the Bible into English. William Wilberforce, the man responsible for the abolition of slavery. Hudson Taylor, great missionary. There are loads of them. They're fascinating. Here's one you won't have heard of. Kit Calvert. Have you heard of him? He was walking down Hawes Main Street when he was 16 years of age, nearly a century ago, and he saw a little leaflet on the floor. He picked it up, read it, and it was a Christian leaflet, and he was converted to Christ. And he had a great concern for the people in the locality that they needed employment. And they were farmers. So what do you do to employ farmers? He started the Hawes Creamery, which makes Wensleydale cheese. There you are. So founded by Kit Calvert. His story's in here. And we must move on because of time. But I was giving out Christian leaflets at the Nidderdale show. It's the very last of the agricultural shows in Yorkshire every year. And I like to go and I give out Christian leaflets. And I've got a little leaflet called A Little Bit of Heaven on Earth in Yorkshire, you see. Anyway, I was giving them out to various people there, and there was a yokel. You have to understand, if you've never been to Yorkshire, that there are many parts of Yorkshire where we still speak with these and thous. Anyway, I gave the leaflet to this farmer, and he said, "Is thou a Yorkshireman, then?" I said, "I am a Yorkshireman." "Was thy father a Yorkshireman?" I said, "My father was a Yorkshireman." But he still wasn't convinced, so he then said, "Does thou have cheese with thy Christmas cake?" And I said, yeah, I always have cheese with my Christmas cake. I can't imagine Christmas cake without cheese. I said, yes, I always have cheese with my Christmas cake. To which he said, thou's a Yorkshireman then. I always says, cake without cheese is like a kiss without a squeeze. And I said, no, all I'm doing is giving out leaflets. Anyway, there we are, Kit Calvert. But there are 31, they're great stories. And even if you're not from Yorkshire, or you were born with a tremendous disadvantage in life and you're born in Lancashire, you'd still enjoy this. Or you might just get it to post on to somebody who is. Have a look at it. That's there. A couple of others, very quickly. I've been advertising Billy's story, saying, look, if you know any atheists, bring them along, and just before the interview, say, if there is no God, explain what happened. Well, of course, it's very popular these days to say there is no God, especially amongst young people. So I wrote a little book called Before You Say I Don't Believe. And it's written for those who say, I don't believe. And I'm asking them 35 questions. Do you really believe that all this came about from nothing? And then I deal with that subject. Have you ever looked at all the fulfilled prophecies of the Bible? How do you explain them? And I look at that. And then how do you explain all the evidence that there is for the resurrection? Anyway, 35 questions. Maybe you are here as somebody who doesn't believe. You might try it. It's only £1. Or you know somebody like that. Why not get it and give it to them with love from me? Okay? There we are. And then just one other thing for children. I think one of my favourite books of all time is the adult edition of this. It's called What the Bible is All About. In fact, it was one of just two or three books I brought down with me for this week. I love that book, and I've got a couple of adult ones there, but I've got a pile of these. What the Bible is All About for kids. And it goes through every book of the Bible, and it's really beautifully done and engagingly done. I just highly recommend it. It is £8. It's supposed to be... Wow! If I told you the price, you'd die of shock. But anyway, it's only £8, and that's enough of the advertising. Let me just say again, you don't have to buy anything, but it's there as a resource. Now, I'd like to read from the book of Psalms. In the Bible, right in the middle, you have a collection of, they're sort of hymns, songs, and we have 150 of them all together, and I want to read from one which is very close to the end, Psalm 146, and then at the very end, we'll look at it. This is what it says. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord, my soul. I will praise the Lord all my life. I'll sing praise to my God as long as I live. Do not put your trust in princes, in human beings who cannot save. When their spirit departs, they return to the ground. On that very day, their plans come to nothing. Blessed are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God. He is the maker of heaven and earth, the sea, and everything in them. He remains faithful forever. He upholds the cause of the oppressed and gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets prisoners free. The Lord gives sight to the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the foreigner and sustains the fatherless and the widow, but he frustrates the way of the wicked. The Lord reigns forever. Your God, O Zion, for all generations, praise the Lord. Well, if you think, what on earth is that to do with a general election? You'll see later on. But before that, it's my great pleasure to welcome Billy McCurry. Shall we give him a very warm welcome?
You want to sit that side?
Yeah, no, that's the big one for you. Billy, it's great to have you. You are very welcome. You're up there as the prisoner, but we'll find out more about that a little later on. You come from Northern Ireland.
That's right. Come from East Belfast. And if you see any footage from Belfast, you'll see two yellow cranes with a big H&W on them. It's where the shipyard used to be. I grew up in the shadow of Harland and Wolff shipbuilders as a young boy.
And... sadly, even today, those who have been around for a few years will remember a period that we call the Troubles. But there are some younger folk here who may not know what the Troubles were about. So 30 years of not quite civil war, but real trouble. What was it all about?
Right. There's always been trouble, violence in Ireland, going back centuries. And there's always been attempts to try and bring about a resolution to the conflict. Coming up to 100 years ago in 1921, Ireland was partitioned. It was cut in two. So there were six counties to the north, predominantly Protestant, wanting to maintain the link to United Kingdom, hence the term unionist, maintain the union, or loyalists, wanting to maintain their loyalty to the crown. And there are 26 counties to the south, an independent republican state separate from the United Kingdom. But within the northern state, there was still a very sizable Roman Catholic minority who wanted to sever the link with the United Kingdom, hence the term republican or nationalist. And so from the inception of the state in 1921, there were seedbeds of violence, and that erupted periodically during the history of the province. And as Roger says, it erupted in the late 60s, and that violence continued until, for three decades.
Okay. Now, you were born in what we'd call then a unionist, a Protestant family.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you were churchgoers, you were very religious?
We weren't a particularly religious family. If anyone encouraged any type of church going, it would have been my mum, who encouraged us to go to Sunday school, a little mission hall round the corner from us. So there would have been that input, but very nominal. My dad had absolutely no interest in God. During the Second World War, his regiment went into Belsen just after it was liberated, and he said what he witnessed in Belsen was enough to convince him that there was no God.
Right, okay. But you as a little lad went along to Sunday school. Do you think you believed the things you were taught? Did you believe in God?
Yeah, I guess as a child, you know, you're brought up in that environment, going to Sunday school, singing the little children's choruses. You do believe that there is a greater being, a God. But really, that was the limit of it. There wasn't any commitment on my part to Christianity or to the things of God.
Now, you had mum, dad. Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, there was my mum, my dad. Had an older sister and an older brother and a younger sister. It was a very happy home. My mum and dad, were a loving couple, and they just worked for the family, for the children.
So and you often say, and I love this, your mum used to go around the house singing as she was doing housework, etc.
Yeah, that's right. I remember as a little boy, you know, my mum going around the house, and she would sing as she cleaned, and she would always sing country songs. So I have a love for country music today, and I think I get that from my mum. Mm. But my sister was in the Beatles and the Monkees and everything, for those of you who are old enough to remember. And my brother was into all things Motown and Rolling Stones. So I've got a sort of...
But it was a happy home.
Well, it was a very happy home, yeah.
But now, Billy, everything was to change, wasn't it? One Saturday. Mm-hmm. But before we find out what happened, tell us about the day leading up to what happened, how you spent it.
All right, yeah. In fact, it was my mum came up that Saturday morning, Saturday the 27th of June 1970, and she woke me up. And she said, "Your dad's going for a walk. Would you like to go with him?" And I'm glad I said yes. So I got up, and me and my dad stepped out onto the main Belfast to Bangor Road, which was literally just outside our doorstep, you know. And we headed up to the local park, Victoria Park. It was a good sort of mile and a half of a walk. The World Cup had just finished. Was held in Mexico, and I remember peppering him with all sorts of questions about football. The moon landing had taken place the year before, and the Apollo program was still, you know, very much to the fore. And that was what was, you know, capturing my imagination as a young boy, more than the violence that had started to erupt in the streets of Belfast and other parts of the country. And so we walked to the park. It was when we stepped out onto the street. Must have been about maybe 8:30, 8:45, but it was a glorious summer's morning. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, and could still feel the heat of the morning sun. And it tolls That day holds so, so many, many precious memories.
Hmm. What did your father do for a living?
He was a labourer. He worked at John Kelly's coal merchant as the coal ships came into Belfast and unloaded their coal. Then he would, you know, one of the drivers that took the coal to hospitals and schools and factories. So that's what he worked at.
So this Saturday, which began so well, was going to end badly and transform your life. Tell us what happened, Billy. I'm sorry to ask you to go over it again, but if you will.
That night, so it was a glorious summer's day. And as you know, the more you go in, the longer you go into the month, the later the nights come, and Belfast being further north, 11:15, you know, it's still bright. It's just getting dark. And so a number of, it used to be the custom, a lot of women would be standing outside talking. And I was sort of just playing about the street a little bit. And there was a sudden blast of automatic gunfire. And it startled everyone, and again, remember the women sort of screaming a bit. And little did I know that was actually the blast of automatic gunfire. It was my dad being killed. And it didn't stop. It wasn't just that there was a blast of gunfire and then that was it. You know, that was the start of shooting that went on for several hours. It didn't stop. And as the shooting, you know, continued, I was pulled into a neighbour's house in the panic. And I was sitting in a single chair like Roger would be in, and I was sitting with my eyes closed. I think people must have thought I was sleeping, but I wasn't sleeping. You couldn't sleep with the gunfire. And as people were coming in and out, I could hear hushed whispers. People saying, "It's awful. It's terrible. Does he know? Has anybody told him?" And I got up of the seat and I said, "What haven't you told me?" And I run out the door. Mm. And hands were trying to grab me, pull me back. And I run out the door and I was running up the street. I can still see the tracer bullets. So I was running into what would be the line of the gunfire. And my friend's dad stepped out and grabbed me. He stopped me. And I was crying from what I remember. Must have thought something was wrong because I was saying, "Where's my daddy? Where's my daddy?" And then he said to me, "Billy, your daddy's not coming home. Your daddy's dead." And I remember saying to him, "Perhaps it's God's will, or this is God's will." And he grabbed me by the shoulders. I was 12 years old. He grabbed me by the shoulders, and he nearly shook the life out of me. And he said, "There is no God," and he's using expletives, "there is no God. It's those across the road," referring to the Roman Catholic community. He says, "It's them across the road. Never you forget that. There is no God." And I guess, you know, from that moment on, I didn't forget who was responsible for my dad's death. And God increasingly became irrelevant to
my life. Your father wasn't involved in the political activities at all, or terrorist activities. He was just in, as it were, the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, he was just coming home that night from a night out. And as he turned a corner, Republican gunmen opened up, knowing that whoever they shot on the other side of the road would be the enemy, as they perceived it. And it's something that happens right across the world, isn't it? Mm. You know, whether it's in the Middle East or the Balkans, you know, people who think whoever I kill from the other side of the street is the enemy.
But devastating for you as a family. Did you go to the funeral?
Yeah. Practically overnight, that family unit that was united in love and happiness found itself suddenly united in sorrow and grief. And funerals in Northern Ireland aren't like England. You know, sometimes I'm a minister up in Ormskirk, and sometimes 2-3 weeks later, you know, you're burying people that have died. Northern Ireland, it's within 2-3 days. So my dad was shot dead on the Saturday night. The funeral was on the Tuesday. That was my older brother's 19th birthday. Hmm. So his 19th birthday, he's carrying his dad on his shoulder in the coffin.
And Billy, your mum, how did she react?
You know, my mum was absolutely devastated. You know, the grief and the level of grief. I can still remember as they were bringing my dad's coffin out of the house, or grabbing the coffin and screaming, "Don't take my husband, don't take my husband." And as a 12-year-old, watching that and watching your mum just have a meltdown. You see the seeds of hate and bitterness. They begin to grow. And it becomes like a cancer. And I hated them for what they had done. I say them, I mean Roman Catholics, not just the Republican movement, but Roman Catholics. I hated them for what they had done.
And your mum stopped singing, didn't she?
Yeah. After that, my mum said she had nothing to sing about. She was 3 months pregnant. And 6 months later, to the day my kid brother was born. And I can still remember him as a little boy running in off the street, running up to my mum and asking what a daddy was. How come his friends had a daddy to talk about? Where was his daddy? Why did he not have a daddy? And again, see, my mum breaking down in tears, trying to explain the hate and the bitterness just goes to another level, goes off the scale.
And Billy, nobody at school or church or anything, nobody tried to help you, counsel you, stop you going down a path to get revenge?
There was nothing like that in those days. Whether, you know, if anyone could have, you know, drawn alongside me in the initial stages and helped, I don't know. That's hypothetical. But certainly there were things that I was writing in school, things that I was drawing in school, things that I was saying that today, you know, would flag up immediately that there's something seriously wrong here. But there was nothing like that back then.
Right. So for the next 3 or 4 years, bitterness really just grew in your life. Is that right to say? Was it fostered by the family? Did they try and say, "Look, Billy, don't be like this"? Or
the family said that, you know, never said don't be like this, because they said, "What else do you expect?" And certainly, as the troubles escalated and continued, that fostered it. And you know, my mum often said, the only reason she never got involved in terrorism was the fact that she had a little boy to look after, a little baby. But, you know, as a family, like so many people have been touched by the madness that has emanated from Ireland over 3 decades. You know, yourselves here in the south of England, you have had bombs quite close to yourselves and people killed in London. So, you know, my family don't have a monopoly on violence, and people react differently when it comes to their doorstep. Not everybody reacted the way my family reacted, but we were just embroiled in hate and an insatiable longing for revenge. And so, you know, I just wanted to leave school and join these guys.
So you did. You joined the UVF, Ulster Volunteer Force, and they were a unionist paramilitary unit, but they were murderous, weren't they?
Yeah, they were the most ruthless of the loyalist paramilitaries. Joined them at the age of 16.
And you knew what you were doing when you joined them at the age of 16?
Yeah, I knew what I was doing. Nobody twisted my arm up my back.
Did you have to take a sort of oath of allegiance? Or?
Oh, yeah, you always swore an oath of loyalty to the organisation. But, you know, there was no twisting of my arm or any coercion or anything like that.
And what did it mean, Billy, to join them? Did they have sort of gatherings? Did they teach you how to use weapons? And what did it involve?
Well, we had weekly meetings, pooled intelligence, for any hits that were going to come off. The night I joined initially the junior wing of the UVF, the commander of the organization of that unit said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, the only thing I want to do is kill people." And he laughed at me and he said, "You know, you'll just have to wait your turn because there's about 60 in front of you, 60 other guys who also wanted to kill." And he says, "You'll just have to wait your turn." And that's what I found frustrating when I was in the organization, that, you know, I wasn't going to get the chance to vent my anger as quickly as I had hoped. And when I was in the organization, I trained in explosives because you can kill more people with a bomb than you can with a gun. And so I was training in.
But eventually you had waited your turn, mm-hmm. and the opportunity came. How old were you?
17.
And what happened? Did they come to you and say, "Billy, this is what we want you to do"? Or how does it work?
Yeah, they initially approached me in October 75, me and a friend who were doing things together within the organisation, and said that there was a hit coming up. I was told it was an IRA man. Would he be interested? And of course, you know, would be interested. That was October 75, and then it was pulled for some reason. In other words, was put on the back burner. And then I was approached again the end of January, beginning of February 76, and told the hit was on again. Was I still interested? And of course I was. And they said, "Well, there's just a couple of things we need to clarify with you. One, it's not an IRA man. He's actually a member of our own organisation. He's a fellow UVF man. But we think he's informing. He's giving information to the police." And they said, "Look, if you don't want to shoot one of our own, don't worry about it. You can pull out. Nobody will think any of the less of you. But everybody in the organisation knows if you inform and to the police, it's an immediate death sentence. So if this guy was an informant, then according to the organisation's rules, he had to die." So I was quite prepared to do that. And the other thing was me and my mate, who initially were told we were doing it, they said, "We only need one of you because somebody else from another unit is going to be on this hit." And me and him were arguing about who was going to do this shooting. And the commander of the organisation pulled a coin out of his pocket and he tossed it. And he said, "Call." And I think I called heads, and it was heads, so I got to do the shooting.
Was your mother, was your family aware of what was going on? Did they in any way try to, restrain you?
Family never tried to restrain me. They encouraged the involvement within the organisation. Now, they didn't know to what extent I was involved. I think they thought it was more or less on the periphery of things, to the extent that it was, you know, just being a lookout. You know, if there was a hit, you know, I would be the one standing at the corner to make sure that the police weren't coming, rather than the ones who were actually carrying out the dastardly deeds. So I think that was what my family thought. That was my level of involvement.
So, Billy, one day you go with a gun and you look a guy in the eye and you kill him.
Mm-hmm.
How could you do that?
Looking back, you know, there's no justification or rationale for it. At the time, if there was a 17-year-old Billy McCurry sitting here, he would have, in a warped way, been justifying his actions and thinking he was perfectly logical. We picked up the guns. We went to the appointed rendezvous. And we had this guy coming, and it was cold, it was callous, it was brutal, it was without mercy. There was no twinge of conscience or any feeling of guilt. There was no remorse, sense of shame. It was just you know, very brutal and bloody.
Did you have nightmares that night?
No.
Any no. night?
I wouldn't say that I had any nightmares or anything looking back, Roger, you know. It was just a... There was a... As far as I was concerned, I had now proven myself within the organisation. And I was going to go on a killing spree.
So you wanted more once you'd killed one?
Yeah.
You wanted more. And there was no sense of, I don't know, crying out to God for help or anything, get me out of this? You were just set on this course of revenge? No,
by that stage, God had been written out of the equation. You know, if there was a God, he could have stopped my dad being shot dead. If there was a God of love, of this all-powerful God that these Christians are talking about, he could have stopped that, and he didn't. So there mustn't be a God, or else if there is a God, he's not interested. So that's...
But Billy, you were caught before you killed anybody else. How much after that murder did you were you arrested?
It was 2 weeks after the shooting I was arrested.
And eventually tried, and what were you sentenced for?
I was too young to be given a life sentence, so I was detained under the Secretary of State's pleasure, which basically is a life sentence.
And you went to, those who remember, it's a notorious prison, the Mays Prison.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's basically where all the terrorists on both sides were kept, isn't it?
Yeah, the Mays was opened in 1971, initially as an internment camp. And his internment wasn't working for various reasons, and it was phased out, and the troubles continued to escalate. The Mays really became a place that held people who were arrested for terrorist-related crimes. The evil in the place was almost tangible, you know. Sometimes... Coming up to Christmas, sometimes people can step out onto the street and there's just something in the air. You think, oh, it feels like Christmas. Well, see, in the Maze, it just felt evil, period.
And what was happening there? What was the first night like? Was it dreadful?
First night wasn't dreadful. From my point of view, it was pride. You know, I was in with fellow comrades, so to speak. And there was certainly pride from my part. It was run along military lines, but our own command structure. The prison authorities weren't allowed into the compound unless they asked permission. So it was just like an army camp.
And you know, I always find this amusing. It's not amusing, but tell us what you were taught in prison.
Yeah, the war didn't stop really. In that part of the prison, in the sense that we wanted to, you know, educate ourselves more so that when we were released, we could continue in our evil deeds. And so, yeah, the guys who had the knowledge in bomb making, we had bomb making classes inside. Now we improvised using bars of soap and things and, you know, the different mixes that would be needed to make up chemical bombs, etc. But those were things that went on.
And the prison authorities could do nothing about it.
They weren't allowed in to the compound.
You see, that's not a sentence that sort of rings true. The prison authorities were not allowed into your section of the prison.
No, not without
without your permission.
Not without permission. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, we won't make comments. I think we all understand. And for yourself, you're sitting there. Were you in your own cell?
It wasn't that when I first went in, as it was like, if you think of those POW camps that you see in
the Great Escape
during the war, yeah, yes. It was like that. If you see any of the, you know, the World War II films with RAF pilots sitting outside Half Moon Huts, Nissen Huts, that's what made up the compound. So it was very open. So it was run along military lines. We, you know, sorted out the day ourselves.
And your attitude, there was no sense of remorse or regret or repentance. You wanted revenge, further revenge.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
So how many years were you there before everything was to change?
5 years.
So 5 years.
Just under 5 years.
But you could have been there much, much longer. Mm-hmm. But suddenly, God, as it were, begins to intervene in your thinking.
Yeah.
How did that begin?
Right. Well, after I was sentenced on the 12th of May, 77, I was transferred to the Eights Blocks. Now, the Eights Blocks were an entirely different ball game, because obviously the authorities were aware that, you know, these compounds were really universities of terrorism. They have to stop this. And so the special category status that we had was done away with. And so the prison authorities had the Eights Blocks where they were going to throw everybody into the mix together. So I was transferred to the Eights Blocks after I was sentenced. And I was only there a matter of, I'm not sure if it was weeks or months, but it was a relatively short space of time when a fellow called Peter Thompson arrived in the Eights Block, and he was carrying a Bible and talking about Jesus. And I knew Peter very well because we were on remand together. And now Peter had also been sentenced and transferred to the Eights Blocks. And he's talking about Jesus, which I thought was really convenient because he's just been given a life sentence. And he wants to get out of prison early. So how are you going to get out of prison early? Well, you have to show the authorities that you're now a good guy. And instead of carrying a bomb, he's carrying a Bible and he's got a bit of religion. So now, as far as I was concerned, he wasn't pulling the wool over my eyes. I knew him from, you know, my remand time. So, Peter, you're a hypocrite, you're a phony. You're trying to pull the wool over people's eyes. You're not going to pull the wool over my eyes. You need a crutch to lean on, and this is a convenient crutch. Now, Peter, as soon as he landed in the Eights Blocks, designated himself the block barber. Okay, so if you needed a haircut, you had to send for Peter. And Peter had never cut anybody's hair in his life, right? But Peter, because he was the block barber, it meant that he could go around the different wings. There was, if you picture an H in your mind, each leg of the H is a wing, and the bar in the middle is the sort of like administration area. So Peter could get round each of those wings. And see, when he got in the chair, he just talked and talked and talked about Jesus. And like, see, if you didn't want anything to do with this stuff, the last one you wanted given all this in your ear was Peter Thompson. And he used to have a really novel way of evangelizing. And this happened on a regular basis. He would get the scissors and he would put them in the side of your neck. And he would apply a fair amount of pressure. And he would say, right, if I apply just a little bit more pressure, I'm into your jugular. And you're lying there in a pool of blood. And see, by the time they get a medic down here to stem the flow of blood, you're dead. And you're not a Christian and you'll be in hell. You know,
we're not recommending this, are we?
Well, if there are any hairdressers in the audience tonight, try it with your clientele to see what happens. But that's the way Peter evangelized, you know. So Peter was my first contact with.
So he began to talk to you about Jesus.
Well, when I eventually sent for him for a haircut. You know, my hair grows really quick. I got this cut a few weeks ago, and I'm nearly like a hair barber on Toretti. And, you know, it used to be months before I sent for Peter, like it was a real sort of afro, because I knew what he was like. And, yeah, he would always talk about Jesus.
Okay, step one. But you were rejecting what he was
saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay, step two.
Step two was around about 1978. Got a magazine that came in a long brown envelope. Postmarked New Zealand, stamped New Zealand. And I only ever opened one of these halfway, and I caught the name of Jesus somewhere in the corner. And I put it back inside the envelope and I threw it in the waste paper bin, because I had no time for God or religion. These magazines came every 6 or 8 weeks, and I threw them in the waste paper bin. To this day, I do not know anyone in New Zealand. It's as freaky as that, but this is how it happened. So these magazines are coming from New Zealand. I'm throwing them in the waste paper bin. Peter Thompson's still running about the place, you know, with these novel sort of means of evangelism. And I thought, well, Peter Thompson could make use of these. And I used to send them to Peter, still unopened. Right? The prison officer would bring them to me. I would see the postmark and say, give that to Peter Thompson. He's into this religious stuff. And that's exactly what I've done.
Okay. Right? That's step two. Step three.
Step three. I went out to the medical room one night, Thursday night in 1980. He used to take really bad migraine headaches. Went out to the medical room, and Peter Thompson was in the medical room. And I said to Peter, I hope you're getting the magazines I'm sending over to you. I don't know who's sending them, but you're quite welcome to them. And before Peter could even answer, the medical officer, a guy called Joe Martin, who became a very good friend, Joe Martin interrupted, and he said, do you not think it's God who's sending you these magazines? I honestly had never heard anything as stupid in my life. You know, God sending magazines from New Zealand to the Mays prison. And I said to this medical officer, I'm skeptical about God. I don't believe God exists. Now, usually if I had said to the likes of Peter Thompson or another Christian prison officer, I'm skeptical about God, they would always, always come back to me with what I now know is a quote from the Psalms, Psalm 14, verse 1, or Psalm 53, verse 1. They're both the same verse. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So I was waiting on this medical officer calling me a fool. He said, oh, you're skeptical about God? And I said, yeah, that's right. You can read these Christians like a book. He's going to call me a fool. You don't believe God exists? And I said, that's right. And he looked at me, and I'm saying, right, I know what's coming. And he said, well, I want to tell you something, kid. Yeah, the fool has said in his heart, there's no God. No. He says, I want to tell you something, kid. Regardless of whether you believe in God or not, it doesn't take away the fact that there is a God. Nor does it take away the fact that if you die in the state that you're in at the moment, you'll go straight to hell. And once you get there, kid, you will not be skeptical anymore. In fact, he says you will be a believer because everybody in that place believes. And the tragedy is this, that once you're there, there's no release date. Hmm. You're there forever. Hmm. I couldn't hit him with a line of argument for you're a fool. He wrong-footed me. Hmm. And I turned and, after I got my headache tablets, turned and hightailed it out of that medical room.
But you're still filled with revenge and hatred, etc., but you're thinking about God now.
Yeah, he sowed a little seed in my mind. You know, if there is a heaven, if there is a hell, no argument. I know where I'm going, but is there a heaven and is there a hell?
You knew where you're going because you felt, hey, I have been bad. I'm not one of these who thinks I'll be good enough for heaven.
That's right. Well, you know, if what these Christians are saying is right, there's a heaven and a hell. Well, there's no argument. If they are right, I know where I'm going on the basis of what I've done. But is there a heaven and a hell? Is there a God? What religion's right? And what I can't give an adequate explanation for, even up to the present day, those magazines that had been coming every 6 or 8 weeks and never read one of them stopped coming after that conversation with Joe Martin.
Hmm. Amazing.
It's just as bizarre as that.
Well, now step four.
Yeah.
What happened then?
Yeah, a woman called Christmas Eve 1980, 24th of December 1980, a woman called Gladys Blackburn came down to my cell. And Gladys was a remarkable wee character. She also became a good friend. She was a member of the Board of Visitors, people drawn from civilian society that can go into prison, make sure it's run along humane lines. And Gladys came down to my cell that Christmas Eve night, and she lifted down the Bible after a bit of formal conversation, and she simply started to read the story of the crucifixion. Jesus on the cross, two thieves either side of him, both of them initially giving Jesus a lot of abuse and blaspheming him. And then one of them rebukes his partner in crime.
So he sort of shouts across Jesus.
Yeah.
To
shouts across Jesus to his partner in crime and says, basically, we're guilty. We deserve what we are getting. But this man, referring to Jesus, this man's innocent. He hasn't done anything wrong. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And she stopped at that 42nd verse of Luke 23. And she just said to me, think who this thief's calling Lord. He's just given him a defined title, called him Lord. And she painted a graphic picture of what Jesus must have looked like on the cross. And as she was doing that, explaining, you know, what Jesus had, you know, experienced with, you know, being whipped, etc., and punched and beaten and hanging naked in this middle cross. As she was explaining that, for the very first time in my life, I felt an overwhelming sense of guilt. You know, I stood in Belfast High Court, as I said, on the 12th of May, 77, and was found guilty of serious terrorist offences, and practically laughed, arrogantly laughed in the judge's face. You know, man's law didn't hold any fear or terror. You know, I held at that time man's law with a degree of contempt, and so I didn't feel any guilt or anything. But that night when I came face to face with the cross of Christ and what was happening, for the very first time I felt an overwhelming sense of guilt. And yes, if I had died in the state I was in, I was going straight to hell, and justly so. And at the same time, you know, as I'm feeling this guilt, I'm realizing for the first time that the punishment that guilt merited and was due, Jesus Christ was taking that on the cross. You know, that's why he was dying. He was dying in the place of the guilty. He was dying in the place of sinners. And he, as the dying thief had said, he's innocent. He knew none of the vileness that characterized my life, any of the evil or any of the repugnance that characterized my life. And yet on the cross, he was taking that sin, taking that punishment. So God wasn't turning a blind eye to my actions. It had to be punished. And yet he was taking that punishment out on his own son. And I was just really amazed at the overwhelming love of God. And that God loved me so much that he sent his son to die for me. And that night, Christmas Eve, 1980.
Gladys left, didn't she?
Yeah.
Because I knew Gladys Platt then. She wrote in her diary, didn't she, that you were very close to trusting Christ.
That's right.
But she left, and that night...
That night, Christmas Eve, 1980. I got down on my knees in the cell, it's block 7 of the Mays prison, and repented of my sin, threw a wasted life before God. There was no claps of thunder, funny mystical experience, or flashes of lightning. It was a simple prayer of faith, and God heard it. If there was anything subjective, I felt clean. There was a peace. All the hate, all the bitterness, all the rage and all the anger went like that, went immediately.
Has it ever come back?
No.
So you prayed, you asked Jesus who died mm-hmm. for you to forgive you and come and live in your life.
Yeah.
And in that moment you felt clean, yes, but the bitterness went.
Yeah. Yeah, all the bitterness and all the anger and all the rage, it went immediately.
How many years ago is that?
That would be 37 years ago this year.
Hmm. Now, time's gone, but I do want to just draw out a few other things, Billy, if I may. How did you tell your family?
Well, I wrote out to my family and friends and told them about this tremendous change that had come into my life. And I got a letter from my mum, and she was asking, how could I talk about a God of love? How could I talk about a God of forgiveness? Where was this great God of love the night your dad was gunned down in the street like a dog by those IRA scum? And she'd underlined it. And, you know, she'd written how she'd met my dad after he came out of the army, at the end of the Second World War, all their plans, hopes and dreams for the future. How all that was taken from us. And where was your great God of love that night? And I must have been reading through Romans at the time. And I wrote a letter based in Romans 12:19. Vengeance is mine, says God, I will repay. Explained here that, you know, my problem and certainly my family's problem was that we thought vengeance belonged to us. Vengeance belongs to God. And I sent a covering letter to my younger sister, who was professing to be a Christian, and said, look, you got to get down and take my mum to church with you. Which she did. And it was a couple of weeks later, I got a letter from my mum. And this is how she opened it. Tonight at church, I now know what you mean about God's forgiveness. Tonight at church, I became a Christian. And all, you know, that hate and bitterness, which my mum knew, which had accumulated over 10 years, again, it went like that. And you know, I said that after my dad was killed, you know, my mum didn't sing anymore because she had nothing to sing about. See, after she became a Christian, she started to sing again. I was over in Belfast last week. She's 89, and she's still singing. Because God puts the song back into the life. And he takes broken lives and he starts to put them back together again and give them meaning and vitality and vibrance.
You're the pastor of a Baptist church now in Ormskirk.
Yeah.
And you're married, you've got mm-hmm. children. Presumably they know about your past.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just tell us about Jonah finding out your youngest.
Jonah's the wee surprise. He's the late one, you know.
There's a lady here who's got a very, very late one on the way. Where is
right.
she?
Well, Jonah's a wee blessing. You know, it was always difficult to know when to tell the kids because I've always been open about my past, and particularly when they go back home to see family and friends, they're aware of things that have taken place in the past. So Jonah with the older siblings sort of gleaned something from them about, you know, his dad's past, that he wasn't hearing from his dad. Because any time he came in and asked me questions, I said, look, you know, don't worry about it, son. So this come back, he's at primary school at this time, and I remember I was sitting in the living room one night, and he came walking in, and he said, he stood in front of me, and he said, you didn't tell me you were a terrorist. And I said, who told you? And he says, I've just Googled your name. and he said, I can't wait to go to school tomorrow to tell all my friends. And I said, oh, Jonah, please, don't go down that road. You'll have the police at this door.
Last question, really, Billy.
Yeah.
And you're not going back up north until later on, so we can, mm-hmm. you know, we can talk with you.
Yeah.
How do you look back all those years, and how do you view it now? Do you, I don't know, does it burn up the sense of guilt still, or how do you see it now?
Oh, you know, I look back with so much regret. You know, I look back on those years with, I said at the time of the shooting, etc., there was no shame, there was no remorse, but boy, there is so much shame, regret, and remorse today. You know, I have no doubt that God has forgiven me, but the consequences of sin, those consequences I still live with. You know, it's 47 years ago this coming 27th of June that my dad was killed. I will relive that day, every moment of that day. And the same on the 19th of February, the day I've shot, took my victim's life. You know, that's just like a video loop in my mind. You know, I can still see it as I'm talking to you now. You can still see it as clear as that morning 41 years ago. So I still live with the consequences of my actions. But I have absolutely no doubt that, you know, God is faithful to his word, that he's forgiven me my sins on the basis of what his son Jesus Christ done on the cross.
And one day you'll be with him in heaven, not because of your goodness, but because he's given to you his goodness and
that's
his
right.
forgiveness.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Roger. It's because of what Christ done on the cross. I'm able to sit here before you tonight and tell you about an amazing God who gives grace to the likes of me.
Billy, I've interviewed you many, many times. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I do, I always shed a tear. I find it deeply moving. But thank you so much for your honesty and coming to share with us. Let's show our appreciation. But thank you, Billy. That's great.